So let me thank first the organizers for this nice event and for the opportunity of giving us this talk. So I'm going to talk about the joint work with my colleagues Carlo Carminati and Stefano Marmi from Pisa. Yes, it's written here that I'm from the Observatory of Paris. In fact, I'm currently working in Pisa with these people. I'm on leave in Pisa. It's been 2 years now, but it seems my colleague Jacques has not yet noticed my absence. So the starting point... the starting point is... a remark by Kolmogorov in his address, Kolmogorov, in his address to the ICM in 1954, where he announces the result about non-linear small divisor problems, which will lead to KM theory. And he mentions the fact that one could try to use Borel monogenic functions to investigate the solutions of small divisor problems as functions of the frequency. Solutions of, say, a KM problem, or he's mentioning several problems in his address. So as functions of frequency. And this idea was explored a little bit by Arnold in his 61 paper. Arnold in 1961 about circle maps. The possibility of conjugating a map, a self-map of the circle to a rigid rotation, and this was also investigated very deeply by Hermann in 1985. Hermann was able to go beyond, because Arnold was limited in his method by some technical difficulty, and Hermann, by the way, Hermann rephrased this definition. Borel theory is something from the beginning of 20th century, and Hermann in his paper, it's the paper in the Bulletin of Brazilian Mathematical Society, he's rephrasing this using a definition very similar to Wittner regularity, but in a complex domain. These Borel monogenic functions are about function in a closed subset of the complex plane, but and you want to retain something of holomorphy, something about Cauchy-Riemann equation. So he's using this definition of C1 holomorphic function, C1 holomorphy. So we'll use, and we are really using this framework, but we are trying to deal, our framework is really KM theory. And we chose the, let's say, the maybe the simplest case to explain. We chose the case of a twist map of the cylinder. Twist maps of cylinder, let's say, R over Z times Z times R. So exact symplectic twist maps, and we chose the case of the standard family. So let me give the definition. So the standard family, you give yourself a function f on the circle, analytic, with zero mean value, and you define a map, key epsilon, in coordinates. So my coordinates are like this. So x for the angle, y for the other coordinate. So an xy is mapped to x1, y1 by this well-known formula. So I hope everybody can read what I'm writing. Well, there's a seat in the front. If it's too small, I'm sorry. And you know that for this kind of map, well, you know when epsilon is zero, you have a foliation by invariant circles, horizontal circles. Each of these circles carries a discrete dynamic, which is a rigid rotation. X1 goes to x plus y. And when you have non-zero epsilon, that small epsilon, you find close to a circle, you find close to a horizontal circle, you find an invariant circle with a given frequency. So let me fix tau, the exponent in the Diophantine condition. I fix it once for all. So, and the Diophantine numbers are those belonging to one of the sets AM. So AM, you just remove from the real numbers, you remove intervals around each rational. So these are my notations. So I put 1 over m q to the 2 plus tau, so that you see that this am increases when m increases, and you see that this has a positive measure if m is large enough, say m at least zeta Riemann zeta function from 1 to tau, and the measure of the union is this is an increasing union and it has full measure. Okay. And then what tells you KM? It tells you that when you pick an omega in this set, AM, inside the real number, you can find a curve, let me call it gamma, which depends on omega, which depends on epsilon, which is an invariant curve with frequency omega. So let me be more specific. I want gamma, this curve gamma should behave like this. T of gamma of theta, so this is a curve parametrized by an angle theta, this should be gamma of theta plus omega. This is what I call an UKM circle, if you want. And you know that it exists and it is unique if you normalize things properly. What I mean is that, so this maybe I should say it now. What I mean is that, in fact, this curve has two components. The first component is theta plus periodic function, u of theta. And once you know this periodic function, you know everything, because the second component will automatically be omega plus u of theta minus u of theta minus omega. And so the curve is determined by u, which should be a one periodic solution to the following equation. So you have this equation, which is a system of two first order different equations. Gamma of theta plus omega means that you should consider theta plus omega, u of theta plus omega, and also the second component at the point theta plus omega, and on the other side you get T of gamma of theta, so you have F of theta plus U, for instance. So I skipped the computation, but you end up with delta omega of U equal to epsilon F of theta plus U. You have a second order difference equation. This is U of theta plus omega minus U twice U of theta plus U of theta minus omega. So this is the second order difference operator. And you have one scalar equation. If you know a solution to this equation, U, then this is an invariant parameterized curve, and this is the KM curve. It is unique. In fact, U is unique if you normalize, so normalized by mean value of U equal to zero. So then it is unique. Okay. So all this is very familiar, and so a way of formulating the KM result, which we want to improve in a sense. What we want to study in this problem is the dependence of the solution, the curve, or the function U. We wanted to see it as a function of the frequency, omega. So we have omega, a point in the Diophantine set, and we map it to U. So U, what you know, that if you fix omega, then the curve depends on epsilon and the parameter is theta. So you end up in a space of functions. Let me use the Hardy space. So this Hardy space means bounded holomorphic functions. Bounded holomorphic functions. All bounded holomorphic functions on this domain, and this domain is a strip for the angle theta. So you complexify the angle, you have a strip, imaginary part of theta less than r, and this is for the epsilon variable. This is the disk. Epsilon has modulus less than rho. So what KM theorem tells you that for every capital M, large enough, if not it's not interesting, large than this, there is, for every M large enough, there is a rho. What is R? Sorry. So you choose R, you choose any R between R0 and R naught, where R naught is for F. So at the beginning, you are given a function f. You assume it to be analytic, holomorphic, and bounded in. So at the beginning, you have R naught positive. You have a function f, which was supposed to be real analytic. So it has a complex holomorphic extension in some strip, R naught. So for any R less than R naught, there exists a rho positive, which depends on M and on the function F, such that this map, UM, this map, is well defined. It gives you a function U with zero mean value, which is real analytic as a function of theta, real for theta real, for epsilon real, and which solves the problem. And we want to study the regularity properties of this function. Of course, something is already known. You see, this function is defined on a closed subset of the real line, which has a large measure. So it makes sense to say that this function is continuous. So it is known that U, M is continuous. And moreover, it's classical result now, that in fact this function is more than continuous, it is witness the infinity. So it has some Witne regularity property. So you need a special definition because it's not an open subset of R. It's a closed subset, but you can define derivatives for this function as a function of the frequency. And the question is, can we do something better? Better would be go in the complex. Can we complexify this map and say something for complex frequencies? This is a natural question because this equation, this is a small divisor problem. And the problem is that when omega is real, you have troubles with rational values of omega, and you must be far enough from rationals. But if you go to the complex, you are far from rational, that's for sure. And it's easy, it's very easy to solve this equation when you are given omega non-real. And you get a unique solution with zero mean value. And so the idea is that, it looks like holomorphic when you go to the complex. But of course, you have troubles with the real values, especially with rational real values. So the first answer is negative in a sense. It's not possible to have a holomorphic extension, but this, nobody would have expected it. So let me state it as a theorem one. All what I'm saying is in our preprint with Carminati and Marmi. And so we state, it's not difficult, but so if F is non-zero, then given any U open neighborhood of a real point, omega star, let's fix a real point in this set, Diophantine point, you take an open neighborhood in C, then there is no holomorphic extension of this UM. UM was defined on the AM, so it's defined on AM in the real part of U intersection with Diophantines, and you cannot extend it holomorphically to U. There is a problem. Still, I want to explain another theorem which tells you that there is something. I have F has zero mean value, so if it is a constant, it is zero. If it has not, zero mean value is important to have invariant curves. If you have a non-zero mean value, then you get translated curves, and you can say the same theory for the standard family. It's not very interesting. So this is due to the special form of the map. Of course, if you take any near integrable family, maybe by chance for a small value of epsilon, it is still integrable, but okay. So this is, you expect this to be very generic in a sense. So the theorem that we want to prove, and we expect it to be true not only for the standard map, is that there is a C1 holomorphic extension of this function UM to a complex domain and moreover this complex domain we call it I give no name for the moment this complex domain will be large enough to yield a very interesting property, which is a quasi-analyticity property. So my goal in the remaining part of the talk is to try to make sense of this word. For the moment, it's very vague theorem. So I should explain what I mean by C1 holomorphic. I should define this domain. I will explain who this domain comes from, Hermann, in fact. And quasi-analyticity, I should explain it. This is the motivation for the title. Quasi-analyticity, you know, it's the fact that in certain functional spaces, for instance, if you take the space of all holomorphic functions on a given open set, well, you have quasi-analyticity in the sense that you have the principle of analytic continuation. Anytime you know the function, if you know the function in restriction to a subset which has an accumulation point, then if your domain is open and connected, you know the function everywhere. Well, in this, for this functional space, C1 holomorphic functions on a certain complex domain, there will be the same property. When you know the function on almost the same property, it will be what we call H1 quasi-analyticity. H1, well, I will explain that. And this means that we can view these, the goal is to view the KM circles not as separate objects. For each Diophantine frequency, there is one circle. But in fact, there is one function, one C1 holomorphic function. In a sense, it is a monogenic function, and it is from one piece. Not a holomorphic function, this cannot be, but something still quasi-analytic. So if you know it somewhere, you know it everywhere. And this is the idea of the communication between these tori, and this communication passes, of course, through the complex domain. Okay, so I should explain C1 holomorphic function now. For this, let us look at the cohomological equation. Let us look at the cohomological equation. To have some intuition of the phenomenon. Because I said it was very easy to construct a solution when the frequency is not real. So let me explain this at the level of the linearized equation, corresponding to this delta omi, delta u. So the this is heuristics. Let us look at the cohomological equation. Delta u is v, so v is given, holomorphic in a strip. And you study this equation. So what will you do? You will expand V in Fourier. You assume V has no zeroth order, zeroth Fourier mode. And the solution with zero mean value, the solution is U, the sum over non-zero Fourier modes of the Fourier coefficient, V hat kappa. You have the EK, the Fourier basis, and there is a coefficient, mu k of omega. So this is the Fourier base, exponential 2 pi I k theta. And this is, well, what happens when you invert this operator. This operator is diagonal on the Fourier base. And you see the eigenvalues. The eigenvalues are, let me use q as a new variable. Q will be the exponential of omega with a 2 pi I. So what are the eigenvalues of the operator? You have q to the k minus 2 plus q minus k. So this is my function mu k, the inverse of the eigenvalue. This is the famous small divisor. When q is, so omega, initially omega was real. Omega is there. The real line is here. And omega is real, so q is on the unit circle. And whenever q is a unit root, this is a pole for this rational function. But when q is e of Diophantine omega, then this is non-zero, and you can estimate things. This is why you can make KAM theory work. You can estimate things. This function mu k. So let us view it as a function of q. It's much better for us. So this is a meromorphic function on C, meromorphic on complex plane. It's even meromorphic on the Riemann sphere, with poles on the unit roots, and estimates, maximum of mu k of q on, so this is E. So if you take real frequencies diophantine, there is an estimate by a constant which depends on m, maybe m squared times something, by and then there is k to a power, I think in this case it should be twice 1 plus 2. And coming from, you have the omega is far from rational, so q is far enough from unit roots with exponent 2 plus tau, and when you put things together you get this familiar estimate. And this is why, for instance, the solution of the cohomological equation is indeed, if you fix q, you get an element of the same functional space. Well, you know that it's better to decrease the width of analyticity. This is the famous phenomenon of loss of derivatives, or when you shrink the strip, etc. And then you have because you have not a bounded operator of this space to itself, of course. But what happens to complex frequencies omega if imaginary part of omega is non-zero? Let's say it's at least little h positive, then it is much better. You can check that your small divisor is not that small. It's larger than it was in the real case. The estimate would be something like, so this uk, mu k, so for this fixed value of omega larger than h, mu k will be O with respect to k, it will be exponentially decreasing, minus twice pi h k. This is even easier to check. So it means that not only it is convergent, but you increase the analyticity width, by the way. In fact, it means that your solution, so let me continue here. It means that your solution U for this precise value of Q, exponential of 2 pi I, a complex number, is holomorphic in a larger strip R plus you gain 2 pi H. And well, that this makes sense, because look at the equation. Here you have V of theta. V of theta is defined only for theta in this initial strip. On the left, you have U of theta plus or minus omega. So if theta is constrained to be in the strip, when omega is non-real, maybe theta plus or minus omega goes out of the strip. But still, it stays in the strip where the solution is defined. Okay. So that's interesting, because it means that you can hope to get solutions outside from real numbers. So this function mu k is our first example of C1 holomorphic function. So in which domain? I want to define C1 holomorphic functions. Well, in fact, you can say, well, it's a meromorphic function. It's a meromorphic function, but when you want to consider all the functions of this kind together, if you take something, even, well, in this problem, we need all of them together. If V is a generic function with all Fourier modes non-zero, except the zeros one, if all the Fourier coefficients are non-zero, then this is not meromorphic with respect to Q. You have poles at every root of unity. Or even if you want to consider something like a sum. Well, let us introduce any parameter S, and you want to consider this function. This function for S fixed with modulus less than 1. So this is a function of Q. So what can you tell? What can you say about the regularity of this function? It is well defined everywhere in the complex plane, except when you are too close to roots of unity. So what kind of idea can you say? Well, it will be holomorphic outside from the unit circle, meromorphic, but the unit circle is a natural boundary. And this is consistent with our first theorem, except that the first theorem is for the non-linear equation, and here we are discussing just the linearized one. So what should we do? We should complexify the Diophantine condition, and we do that exactly in the same way as Hermann did it in his paper. So complexification of the domain. So now let me explain in which complex domain we work. Maybe I can do this here. So first, you notice that I prefer to deal with the variable Q rather than omega, but this is transparent and this is innocuous. So let me use this variable Q. So it was coming from, this is the plane of the Q variable. So here I was deleting around P over Q, I was deleting an interval with length 2 over m q to the power 2 plus tau. So now I'm deleting a lozenge in the complex plane. I'm deleting lozenges like this. So for instance, around 0, there is a big lozenge, etc. So correspondingly, so this, the real part was my domain AM. So now I have a complexified AM, AMC. It is all complex numbers omega such that, well, you do not belong to any of these lozenges. Well, I take the fixed slope here, always the same slope. So not to be in any lozenge means that there exists a point omega star which is in the real domain with, another way of saying it is that for every real Diophantine number, there is a cone here, which is good. So there exists omega star in the real set, the real set, such that imaginary of this omega is at least real part of omega minus omega star. If you think a moment, you see that this is the same as the excluding these lozenges. And when you apply the exponential map, you get a domain Km, which is E of this complexified domain, and I like to add 0 and infinity so that I get a closed subset of the Riemann sphere. So I add 0, I add infinity, and I have deleted the images of the lozenges. So I have a big lozenge around 1, which is distorted by the exponential map, and something like that. And the complementary of these lozenges-like domain is a closed subset, a compact subset of the Riemann sphere. So Km is a compact subset of the Riemann sphere, and it has big measure, and when m goes to infinity, you have full measure, etc. So this is my domain. So if I use this domain, you see that this is very nice because this estimate was on E of AM, but it is the same estimate for this meromorphic function is true on KM. It's a computation. You have to do something to check it, but it's possible to check it. You can, in a sense, you can, of course, it was exponentially decreasing when we were far from the real, but in this complexified domain, it is still possible to go to the real if you go through the Diophantine set. So you cannot expect to have the exponential decay. But still, you have no more than polynomial growth with respect to the Fourier mode K. And this is sufficient to make KAM proof work. We know it in the real case. So in the complexified case, we expect it is the same. And indeed, it works. So we have a good domain. So for instance, this function, I was asking the question, if you take this kind of function, well, you put together infinitely many such meromorphic functions, what kind of regularity do you expect in the domain Kn, in this domain where you have removed... So the claim is that this is an example of a C1 holomorphic function. This function, for instance, is C1 holomorphic in this domain, Km, and also this one, so if you view it as a function of Q, Q will stay in Km, my compact subset of the Riemann sphere, and the image will belong to the same Banach complex space. So I have a complex Banach space. So it's a refinement of the real claim. So if you consider this function extended to this complex domain, then you still have this regularity. So I must tell you now what I mean by C1 holomorphic. But it's, well, you can imagine it, in fact. You can imagine it, but... So let me say it for a function... So imagine K is a closed subset. So it's a definition. I take a closed subset of C, and then later of C hat, the Riemann sphere. I take a function phi is defined on K, a function phi on K is said to be C1 holomorphic on K if phi is continuous, there exists a continuous function psi such that when you consider the phi of q prime minus phi of q, you divide by q prime minus q. This is well defined for q prime different from q, and when q prime tends to q, it should tend to psi of q. So if you are familiar with Whitney regularity, you see it's just the same definition, except that we are using division by a complex number. So it's equivalent to saying that as a function of two real variables, real part and imaginary part of Q, you have C1 differentiability in Whitney sense, but the C1 differential, the differential is given by multiplication by a complex number. So it's Cauchy-Riemann equation for this differential, this Whitney differential that you have. So this is the definition. Of course, if we take always our subset K is arcwise connected, it's connected. So in particular, there is no isolated point. So we prefer to use perfect sets without isolated points. Then this function psi is uniquely determined by the function phi. So then psi is unique. So, and you make a complex Banach space. You can define a norm. So you make a norm, so it's technical, but in a sense it's important to do it properly because so if I have any closed subset of C, I can do this. It will be convenient to assume that phi and psi are bounded. So let me call this omega phi. Well, let me say that this is going to zero, and this difference is omega of q q prime. It depends on phi and psi, but if there exists psi, psi is determined by phi. And then what is the norm of a function? So So the norm, the C1 holomorphic norm on K is the sum of the sup of phi. So we assume phi bounded. Well, anyway, at the end, we apply it to a compact subset of the Riemann sphere, so it will be automatic. But for the moment, I have a closed subset of C. So I assume phi bounded on K. Then I add the sup of this on K times K. And I add the maximum between the sup of supremum of the derivative psi and the sup of on K by K of delta phi, little delta phi means it's a function of q prime. It's just the difference between phi of q prime and phi of q. So you have another function of two variables, and if you take this formula, then you get a Banach algebra. I mean, this is very important to us, that the norm of a product is less than the product of the norms, and this is why we do things in Fascan. So, I mean, this is a lemma, easy but important. We get a Banach algebra with inequalities for the product. And then, well, all this needs to be adapted to the case where K is a closed subset of the Riemann sphere. So there is an easy adaptation to. You just take, well, in a subset of the Riemann sphere, you have two coordinates. So you look at the function without infinity, and you can do the same. And then you'd look at the function in the coordinate at infinity, so you lose the origin, but you can do the same. And then you take the maximum between the two. So you have two restrictions of the function, which are defined in subset of C, and take the maximum between. So there is a very natural adaptation to the general case. So I consider that at this point, we know in which domain we work, Km. We know in which class of functions we hope to work. We hope to have at the end only C1 holomorphic functions. And now, well, now theorem 2 is clear. Now the statement is, if you consider this domain Km, your function um, which was well defined in the real thanks to Km theory, extends to this domain Km as a function of Q, which is the exponential of the frequency, and the result is a C1 holomorphic function. Now there is another theorem which tells you that the space of all C1 holomorphic functions on this kind of domain is H1 quasi-analytic. So this I should explain it to you now in 5 minutes. So what does it mean? So I'm afraid I have no time to tell you more about theorem 2. So the theorem 2, let's say, without this part, is um extends as a C1 holomorphic function to this domain. So what can be the proof of that? The idea is that you take a proof of the Km theorem in the real case, and you try to complexify it. We hesitated a little bit, which shows a very nice proof written by Mark Levy in an article. Well, in fact, it's co-authored by Jürgen Moser. It was published very soon after Jürgen's death, after his lectures, and it's a very nice proof because you stay with functions of the variable theta. You see, we are looking for u of q. U of q lives in a space of functions of the variable theta and epsilon. So in what they do in this paper is that they build the solution u, they obtain it as a limit of a sequence of function un, which are solved by modified Newton method, apply to this equation. So you do not change coordinates. You do not use transformation theory. You stay with coordinate theta. It's a Lagrangian proof. You stay in the configuration space, variable theta, with this second order equation. And you build a sequence of functions un of theta, and you using, well, Newton's scheme modified, and the limit is the solution of the problem. Well, we just do the same, except that we check that at each step, we get only C1 holomorphic function in Km, but we already, we more or less saw the linearized equation, so it's more or less that's what we do. We check the convergence in this Banach space of C1 holomorphic functions. Okay, so why does it mean that there is only one Km curve? In what sense is there any quasi-analyticity property? Well, the result is that, it is contained in a paper that we published recently in the bulletin of the Brazilian Mathematical Society. So, I mean, I give the reference. Bulletin of Brazilian Mathematical Society, 2011. So, this is a theorem which tells you that C1 holomorphic functions on K is H1 quasi-analytic. So H1 quasi-analytic. So K is a domain like this one. What is important is that K is obtained by removing. So you have the Riemann sphere and you have two Jordan curves. So you have two Jordan curves. This is one. And you have another one which is external. So I mean, and the space between these are the lozenges which are prohibited. But so you have two Jordan curves, and K is what is inside, so the inner part, and what is outside, the external part. And moreover, you assume, very important, you assume that the measure of the intersection, so you have the intersection of these two curves has an intersection. Is non-empty, and it has positive Hausdorff measure, positive linear Hausdorff measure. So this is linear Hausdorff measure. I mean, one-dimensional, how could I say? One-dimensional Hausdorff measure. So you assume some positive measure for the positive Hausdorff measure for this intersection, and then the space is H1 quasi-analytic. What does it mean? It is a linear space, and the only function which vanishes on a subset, a given subset with positive H1 measure, is the zero function, the trivial function. So given any domain, any subset E, included in the domain is K, with positive H1 measure, so this is the external Hausdorff measure in one dimension, given E like this, the only function of this space which vanishes, which is zero on E, is zero everywhere, zero on K. So if you, in particular, it means that, in a sense, any function of this space is determined by its restriction to E. Because if you have another function with the same restriction, the difference must be zero everywhere. And this is what happens here. So it means that we have this complexified small divisor problem, this complexified equation. I told you it was easy to solve it when Q is far from the unit circle. Imagine Q is close to the origin, for instance. Well, take a neighborhood of the origin has positive Hausdorff measure, or take any curve, or if you wish, take any positive measure subset of the unit circle. and take the restriction of the solution to this set, then it contains the information about all the real KM curves and all the complex KM curves. So there is only one KM curve, there is only one function which encodes simultaneously all these functions, and if you wish, you can compute this function from its Taylor expansion at the origin, which is not so difficult. Thank you for your attention. Non-smooth. I don't know. I mean, I was speaking of the Diophantine KM curve, the one with. I did not say what was monogenic. Monogenic means that you take the union of all these compact subsets K, and so at the end you get all the complex points except the Liouvillean ones, the non-Diophantine ones. And what I was saying that all the KM curves with Diophantine exponent belong to this monogenic space which has this property. I'm not speaking of the KM curves without, which have no not Diophantine frequency. Ah well, KM curve here, and while epsilon small enough, it is the. There is the theorem is that the function is C1 holomorphic. The function U is C1 holomorphic on KM with values in a complex. Ah yes, what I had in mind was the statement. Where is it? With the. Now, the solution UM extended is C1 holomorphic on KM with the U in my complex Banach space, holomorphic functions bounded on SR times D rho. But rho depends on M. Maybe this is the point. For M given, there exists rho such that there is C1 holomorphic function in KM with values in this complex Banach space, and the restriction of this function is the one we knew from the beginning. No, because F is multiplied by epsilon, and epsilon is of modulus less than rho. Yeah, there is an epsilon. Epsilon is somewhere in. I mean, you see, there is an epsilon. I'm considering epsilon F. So it's perturbative KM theory. Epsilon small enough. This is our framework. So epsilon is a variable. So it's a variable. But this variable lives in a disk, which depends on M. The disk has radius rho, which is explicit. This rho of M you can take constant divided by M to the power 8. Maybe it's not optimal, but exactly. Like in the usual, by the way, I think in the usual KM theory, you have constant divided by M square. We have M to a higher power because we need to control derivatives of with respect to Q. Maybe 8 is not optimal, but so of course it depends on M, but this is what I said at the beginning when I reformulated the usual real KM theorem using this target space, and if you use the same kind of target space you can complexify and get a C1 holomorphic function. This is all what I said, and this space enjoys this H1 quasi-analyticity property. So in this sense, all the KM solutions with Diophantine frequency corresponding to epsilon small enough are encoded in this section. Yeah? Yes, this is done in our first paper, this one. This because this was done by Hermann, in fact. So what we just quote Hermann's result. Well, Hermann was limiting himself to a narrow strip around the unit circle for technical reasons. We have to include zero and infinity. It's important for our result relies on tools of functional analysis in complex variable with one complex variable. So we need to have something simply connected inside, something simply connected outside to invoke some classical theorems. So Hermann was not doing this. So we had to add this to the result of Hermann, but it's an easy result that we added. And when you put things together, you have the same kind of result in this paper for the circle maps. Not yet, but we expect to be able to do something. Yes, we would like to to say it, but well, we see no obstruction except that we should imagine a good definition in higher dimension. But the principle you see is, I mean, look at the cohomological equation. We expect that it should, there's something analogous should be true. And well, but for the quasi-analyticity, it's strongly one-dimensional, but in print, it could be easier, in fact, with many dimensions, because it's easier, already the theory of analytic continuation is, in a sense, is easier when you have more complex variables.